This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
But I put it out of my mind. I had better things to do. I had a bike park to check out.
If you were like me as a kid, you probably remember staring out that classroom window in the late spring, longing to go outside.
So far, give me a quick retell.
So far, this guy told us about his bike.
For Ms. Scher's second grade class at Red Oak Elementary, that dream has come true. One by one, each of them sits on the ground with the teacher, who helps out with a tricky word.
What's that word?
Exclaim.
Long A?
Exclaim. Exclaim.
Let me hear your...
The students head back to school. Administrators are trying to figure out how to keep them safe from COVID-19. They're looking outdoors for the answer. And the kids, by the way, are thrilled.
My favorite thing about the school is that the campus is mostly outside. It's more comfortable than our desk because we stay inside a lot. And it's, like, really relaxing outside than inside.
I do like running outside. It's really nice and peaceful.
Transforming a campus might not be a big project for a school with grass fields and plenty of acreage. But what if your school has an asphalt playground, few trees, and a tight budget? KCRW's Kaylee Wells has the story of two campuses on either end of the spectrum that have managed to bring their kids outside.
Carrie Scher brings her kids out here to a small concrete stage for reading time every day. And after a year on Zoom, what a relief.
We've been reading for so long on iPads. So that they have actual books in hand, they're just so happy. Just the fresh air, I feel, gets them excited. And just being outside is nice. And we get to hear all these wonderful birds. So it's just kind of peaceful.
Researchers like Marcy Rainey at Occidental College have known for years that when schools have green space, kids thrive.
We're no longer thinking of learning as being restricted to sitting in desks in rows in a space where there's someone standing at the front of the classroom telling you what to know. And it kind of disrupts what we think of traditionally as the optimal learning environment. And actually, it is the optimal learning environment that we haven't been taking advantage of.
She says when kids are outside, their stress levels decrease more quickly. And it's even better when outside means grass and trees instead of an asphalt handball court. She studied kids at two campuses in Eagle Rock just before the pandemic sent everyone home. One ripped up the asphalt and renovated their grounds, and the other didn't.
Some of the other findings we saw was the change in their standardized test scores over the time that after the renovations happened, so post 3 years, we saw specifically with language arts a decrease in the achievement gap between the low income and the non-economically disadvantaged students, showing that equity is a big part of why we should be promoting living schoolyards or green renovations and outdoor space.
Fewer kids got sent to the principal's office, they played more collaborative games instead of competitive ones, and the kids who sat on the sidelines were more likely to jump in. Before they renovated their campus, the school in that study consulted a California-based nonprofit called Green Schoolyards America, and it's led by a woman named Sharon Danks.
We work to help them transform their asphalt-covered school grounds into more park-like green spaces that improve children's well-being and learning and play, while also contributing to the ecological health and resilience of the city around them.
They've been around for decades, but she says she's seen 10 times as many schools asking for their help since the pandemic hit.
I'd say around 15% of the schools had tried at least one outdoor classroom on their own grounds. And then when the pandemic hit, we started getting inquiries from the other 85% that had never tried it, but could see that this was a way that might provide them more space or fresher air or other resources that they could use in the pandemic.
Red Oak Elementary in the Oak Park School District is part of that 85%. Oak Park Superintendent Tony Knight says so far, it's been a big hit.
When the kids are outside, they're noticing other things. When we were going along that wall,
We have a tree that's an incredible color of violet that's blooming right now. So hopefully that would encourage your child to notice that, and then our teacher to design a lesson around what's going on with that particular tree that maybe wasn't on the menu that day.
Yeah.
You know, so you see and you notice different kinds of things when you're outside. You know, and then it's starting to incorporate more nature-based education into our curriculum.
It's in a suburban neighborhood just north of the Ventura County line, where grass and square footage abound. Creating outdoor classrooms was a matter of buying new tables to put under the solar panel array between the soccer field and the jungle gym, or putting pavers in the shade of one of the school's 87 trees. The state and federal COVID funding more than covered that. Things look a little different at Kingsley Elementary in Little Armenia. The sound of birds is accompanied by the consistent drone of the nearby 101 freeway.
As you can see, the majority of our campus is asphalt.
This is Principal Karina Salazar. She points out a grass field about a quarter of the size of the one at Red Oak. There are a few trees around the perimeter, but most of the playground is in direct sunlight, and almost every square inch of the campus already serves a purpose.
And so part of this project is really about creating more opportunities for students to have shade, to be able to work outdoors, and to have more greening. So it's part of creating more green spaces on the campus.
The school created four outdoor classrooms that can be shared by all the teachers. The new classrooms sit on what was part of the schoolyard. They set aside $15,000 and managed to finish under budget. How? They were clever, thrifty, and resourceful.
So this is our woodsy sage classroom, also known as the mulch classroom, because it's
about a 20 by 30 mulch square that was carved out of that grass field.
There's 12 handmade wood desks here. So this one,
those wooden desks were made for free by one of the teacher's dads.
And then each desk has a student rug, so students can have flexible seating opportunities in addition to the tree stumps where students may want to read independently.
The tree stumps were donated by a local nursery. LAUSD bought most of the tents that shade the classroom as a COVID safety measure. And the planters that, when fully grown, will serve as nature walls, were put together by volunteers. Salazar says teachers reserve the outdoor classrooms for their kids, and already all four rooms are fully booked for the rest of the school year.
I conducted an assessment of our teachers, and there was an overwhelming response that they were in favor of using this type of tool. Of all the teachers that expressed an interest in being outdoors, more than half of them wanted to be out here more than half a day.
The principals at Red Oak and Kingsley both say what started as a COVID safety measure will likely be a permanent addition to the campus. The next step at Red Oak is designing new classroom buildings with sliding doors that open into outdoor learning spaces. For Kingsley, it's figuring out how to take out some of the asphalt schoolyard and replace it with something greener. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Let it bump, though.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with KCRW's Greater LA, I'm Steve Chiotakis. LA County is on track to enter into the yellow tier by next week. That's the least restrictive of all the COVID tiers put in place about a year ago. And in the course of the past few weeks, more doors to businesses and services have reopened. And starting Monday, libraries will too. Now, early on in the pandemic, you may remember that local governments called on librarians to join the coronavirus fight as contact tracers. Last year, in a few episodes of GLA, you heard from Lupi Leva, a senior librarian in Boyle Heights, about what it was like to do just that. Well, now, Lupi and others are going back to their day jobs as, you know, librarians. And she's back with us to talk about getting back to her old job. Hey, Lupi.
Hi, Steve. Nice to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you as well. I know you're anxious to get back to work. You work over at the Robert Louis Stevenson branch of the LA Public Library System in Boyle Heights, as I mentioned. You're reopening on Monday. Tell us about that, and what do you have to do to prepare?
Well, we're really excited, first of all, to welcome back the community. It's amazing how much we've actually missed our patrons. I've been talking about it with other colleagues, and we're really excited. So as far as the LA Public Library System, not all our branches are going to be opening, but we do have 37 branches and the Central Library that are going to be offering services. Now, as some of your listeners may know, we have had Library to Go, which is curbside service, for a while. That's been going on for several months. That will continue. So some folks prefer curbside service, rather, and they're very welcome to continue with that. But those of us who are going to be opening, we're actually going to be opening our doors again. Some branches throughout the system will be opening for browsing. And some of us, including my own branch, we're going to be opening for browsing. And also we're going to be offering computers. So a lot of our patrons like to come into our branches to use our computers, and those are going to be available. Of course, we are working in reduced capacity. We do have to go by the Department of Public Health's reopening library protocols. And we've taken a lot of steps to make sure that everybody is safe, staff and patrons. And basically, we want to make sure that we have a safe and welcoming environment for everybody so that everybody can enjoy coming back to the library.
When you talk about safely, doing this mm-hmm. all safely, you know, one of the things about the library is that you're looking at books.
Yes.
And a lot of fingers touch a lot of pages in those books and things like that. But you're taking precautions to make sure those things that people collectively touch all the time are safe.
Yes, we were isolating materials according to, again, the Department of Public Health's order. The revised protocols have reduced that, so we don't have to isolate library materials. In the past, sometimes folks would return their books and they wouldn't come off their records for a while because we did have to isolate them. But what we're doing now is we're making sure that everything is being sanitized on a continuous basis. It has to be done on at least a daily basis, which we were cleaning the libraries on a daily basis beforehand, but everything is being continuously sanitized. And for example, we've taken some steps, such as our public computers. One example is that our public computers were upgraded. So the keyboards and mice that we use now are actually medical grade. It just makes sanitizing a whole lot easier. So, and those are obviously high touch items. So those are going to be, it's much easier to clean and disinfect basically with the medical grade keyboards and mice. And of course, we're going to have sanitizing and disinfecting continuously throughout the day. High touch areas, public restrooms, for example, which are going to be open at the branches that are open to the public. And of course, we do have, for example, plexiglass barriers, such as at other places, between staff and patrons at our service desks. We do have decals so that people can be mindful of social distancing inside the branches. And of course, we do have capacity limits. Now, as people who are familiar with our branches know, our branches, some of our buildings are a lot bigger and some of our buildings are a little bit smaller and cozier. So every branch that's opening to the public will determine its own capacity according to our limits and according to, again, the reopening protocols from the Department of Public Health. So we will have a welcome station at all the branches that are opening to the public where our patrons can go and ask questions. In some cases, again, depending on our communities and our buildings and how and our staffing capacity, in some places our welcome stations will actually be outside the building. So, for example, at my library, our welcome station is outside the building. So if people want to know what services we offer, if they're a little bit hesitant to come inside the building, they can come to our welcome station, which is outside, ask us questions, see what kind of things we may be able to provide outside. And if they really need to come inside, of course, they're welcome to do so. But we are going to be keeping an eye on things outside as much as we can.
You mentioned, of course, the computers and libraries, Loopy, are access points for many mm-hmm. Angelenos. Folks can get access to the internet. They go there for the computers, maybe even just to find a place to hang out. I mean, do you think mm-hmm. post-pandemic some of the unhoused residents who used to go to the Stevenson branch will be able to return and that it can be that place where people can gather and, you know, look things up on the internet or find the resources that they need?
Well, I think eventually we want to go back and offer the best of what we used to offer. So what everybody loves about libraries, at some point we're going to be able to offer that again. Currently, because of our limits, because of our capacity limits, we are asking for people to come in and browse and borrow for a limited time. So we are asking people right now. I know a lot of people love to come to the library and hang out all day. Right now, that's not possible, again, because we do have to adhere to the capacity limits and the reopening protocols from the Department of Public Health. So right now, if you want to come in and grab some books, you're welcome to come in, browse through the collection. But we do ask that you try to keep your visits as brief as possible. Now, in the future, we do want to go back to be able to open our doors all day for whoever wants to come in, because basically libraries do welcome everyone. And we try to respond to our communities as best as we can. Of course, keeping in mind that, like I've said before, communities are different. You know, my library, my community in Boyle Heights has different concerns and different ways that we try to serve the community than, say, libraries in Brentwood, for example. But we all have as our main purpose, serving our community. And so what we want to try to do is we do want to try to offer our communities everything that they love about libraries. But like I said, it's a rolling reopening. Right now, we're slowly, just like the rest of society, we're slowly going back to opening. And so it's going to be incremental. It's going to be a little bit at a time. Not all our branches are open yet. More than half of our branches are going to be offering some type of service. And right now, the best thing to do is to go to our website at lapl.org/reopening, because that has all the details about which branches offer what types of services, our hours, everything. Yeah, all the questions that people might have are probably going to be answered there.
Are you done with contact tracing? I mean, COVID's still here.
I am, personally. But there is still a core group of city employees who are still doing some contact tracing, along with county employees. Now, I don't know how long that might go on, but I know most of us are back at the library and trying to get everything ready to welcome our public back.
On Monday, Lupi Leyva, librarian turned contact tracer turned librarian again over in Boyle Heights. Lupi, congratulations. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. The Summer Olympic Games were supposed to take place in Tokyo last year. Like many aspects of our lives, they were put on hold. But if all goes according to plan, those multicolored rings will be raised again this summer in July. And if all goes according to plan here on Greater LA, we're going to talk to some of the local athletes who hope to compete. One of them is water polo player Max Irving. He's from Long Beach. He won 3 NCAA championships playing at UCLA, but these days you can find him playing the game professionally in Greece. And that's where Max Irving joins us right now. Andio, Max.
Yasu. Thank you for
having me. Yeah, my Greek family would love to talk to you as well, I'm sure. You're playing on the professional level there. Is there no professional water polo league here in the United States?
So water polo is a bit of an interesting sport here in the U.S. I would say the highest level that we have is going to be the Division I NCAA championship. So that's about the extent that we have in the U.S. So if you want to continue playing and if you have Olympic aspirations, the best way to take your game to the next level would probably be going overseas and playing professionally in leagues, maybe in Italy, Hungary, and like Greece, where I'm at.
Can you make a living at it?
Yeah, I definitely think you can make some money. Initially, when you're a foreign player, especially from the U.S., most of these teams overseas, they're not going to be super familiar with who you are unless you have already played in like a world championships or an Olympics. But kind of once you, it might take a year or a year or two to kind of break in to their domestic leagues, you can definitely make a living, because the way that usually the contracts are set up, they're paying for the majority of everything. They're paying for housing and meals. And then on top of that, you're provided with like a monthly stipend. And then from there, you can definitely make a living, I would say.
The U.S. does very well, by the way, when it comes to swimming. Obviously, swimming is important to water polo as well. But the men's team, Team USA, has never won a gold medal in the Olympics in water polo, right?
The men's national team has not won an Olympic gold medal. The most recent medal won was 2008 in Beijing when the team took silver. So, I mean, that was great. But I think this year going into the games, I think we're going to be well equipped, you know, to do well. We have the majority of our players now are playing professionally. So I think we're going to do well this summer. I think we're all looking forward to it. So we'll be ready to play it this summer.
Talk a little bit about water polo, Max, because I think a lot of people don't realize how fit you have to be to play water polo. That it can be a pretty rough sport. I mean, there's contact that goes into it, right? Under the water. What's allowed and what's not allowed for you know, the lay people who don't understand what water polo is?
Yeah, so water polo, maybe one of the best ways to describe it, I would say it's very similar to ice hockey and a little bit of soccer, and the fact that you have a goal, you're in the water, it's 6-on-6, pretty much anything under the water is allowed. There's a ton of wrestling and grappling on the perimeter. Yeah, 30 seconds to swim down a 30-meter course, go on offense, attack, and try to essentially just throw the ball into the goal the best way that you can. And the defense is going to try to stop you and doing everything in their power to do so. And then if you score, you go back to half and line up and do it again. Or if without a goal, then you're just going to go counterattack, basically back the other way, swim another 30 meters. And then the other team is going to have their opportunity.
I want to talk more personally about you playing the sport because, I don't know much about water polo, but it seems like it's not a particularly diverse group of athletes. You're African American. Is that ever weird for you in some ways? I mean, has it been an issue anytime in your career?
Like you said, I'm African American and I'm playing water polo, which is a predominantly white sport. But I've been very fortunate in my experiences with water polo. I mean, I started playing when I was like in 10 and under, so at a very young age. And for the most part, all my teammates and all my coaches were very inviting and very accepting of me and who I am personally. I think I'm from Long Beach, and Long Beach is a very diverse community demographically and culturally. So I think just having that diversity within the community, I mean, I think that really helped, you know, just beginning to play water polo and kind of like my personal experiences playing.
Right. And if you're good, you're good. Right?
Exactly.
I mean, that's the way it should be.
No, but I was just saying that it really is special, you know, being African American and playing a predominantly white sport, because I'm able to represent a community, you know. So if I can be an inspiration just to maybe one kid to try something new, or just to encourage them that they can do anything within or outside the realm of sports, then I think my playing career will have been an absolute success.
Amen to that. And you know, the question, I guess, now, forget about all the other stuff, but I mean, we're in the middle of this pandemic and you've been trying to train. It's a pretty intimate sport. You know, public swimming pools have been closed. How have you been doing this in Greece? Greece was hit pretty hard. I don't know where it is right now, but Europe is still seeing a big rise in cases. How are you doing all this?
Yeah, so I think being overseas, it actually provides not only me, but my teammates with an opportunity, like I said earlier, to be able to train consistently compared to in the US, because I mean, almost a year ago from now, that was probably one of the toughest times that we had as a team, just because we were constantly trying to find a pool. And this was back in the early stages of COVID. So it was really navigating the unknown. And there was a huge liability aspect of just like these pools, either high school pools or maybe college facilities, that they didn't necessarily know if they wanted to take on 20 to 25 athletes. So, I mean, it's really actually been a blessing that we have been able to come overseas and play in a league that is for the most part open. I mean, we still have protocols, like, so we have, I mean, testing 2 times a week, testing before every game. So I think like there's a lot of due diligence that goes into it. But I mean, for the most part, I think we're definitely managing, and being able to have the opportunity to play overseas has been great.
Max Irving, we hope to watch you in Tokyo this summer. Water polo player from Long Beach. Max, good luck in the piscina, in the swimming pool.
Thank you. But it's still bad, I believe.
Well, finally today, before you leave us, a heartfelt thanks. Today marks 2 years of Greater LA. We didn't know what would come down the pike on April 29th, 2019. On that day, it was Tony Cuevas doing his thing to a line of old cars on Terminal Island in an episode we titled Where Cars Go to Die.
Well, most of these cars, I think a good percentage, maybe 90 plus percent of the cars here in Southern California are going to have to pass through one of our shredders.
Shredded means just what you think it does, like that paper shredder that you have at home or the office. A giant mechanical claw, like the one inside the game you always lose at in the arcade. It takes a flattened car and puts it on a conveyor belt to get ripped into pieces. Well, since then, we've been through so much together, from shredding to exploring to quarantining to marching to recovering to, on the regular, connecting you to the people and places of Southern California. Thank you for your ears and your time.